Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Hi everyone, welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, June 10, 2026, we are delighted to host a discussion titled, What Can State and Federal Regulators Do to Control the Cost and Maintain the Reliability of Our Electric Service? My name is Louis Chong, and I am a Rising 3L at Cornell Law, serving as a student liaison to the Administrative Law Practice Group Executive Committee at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, I will keep the introductions brief, but if you would like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have Commissioner Mark Christie and Commissioner Bernard McNamee as our speakers, and Mr. Ken Davis as our moderator. Commissioner Christie is the founding director of the Center for Energy Law and Policy at William & Mary Law School, as well as the former chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the Virginia State Corporation Commission. Commissioner McNamee is a former FERC commissioner and an energy regulatory attorney. Mr. Davis has over 40 years of experience in corporate management, public service, and the private practice of law, mostly in the electric industry. He is also the former Deputy Attorney General for Virginia. One last note, throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature in Zoom so that we will have access to them for that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. Mr. Davis, the floor is yours.
Thank you for the introduction and especially for the opportunity to discuss this important subject with two so qualified, experienced public officials and practitioners, Commissioner Christie and Commissioner McNamee. Let me set the table for our discussion. After two decades of flat or relatively flat demand, U.S. electricity demand has now in recent times been experiencing rapid growth. Demand is expected to increase 25% in the next 5 years, with data centers contributing to approximately half of that. Now, this increased demand is pushing up electricity prices, as utilities and other suppliers scramble to fund and construct massive amounts, over $1.4 trillion worth of infrastructure over the next 5 years to meet this surging demand. Now, as I say, as a result of the build-out and increased demand, prices, electricity rates are going up. Average residential bills increased by nearly 30% since 2021 and are expected to continue increasing this year. All of this adds to the general inflation concerns of Americans and public officials. And it also contributes to the opposition to the construction and deployment of data centers. Now, this combination of demand growth and price inflation is not inevitable. It's not always been this way. Dramatically, in the period from 1955 through 1970, while electricity usage, electricity demand exploded, surging approximately 170% over that period of time, at the same time, inflation-adjusted real average residential electricity rates plummeted they declined by approximately 27%. Now, that's dramatically different, and it's a long time ago. And over that period of time, the regulatory regime at the state and federal level for the electric industry has changed dramatically, especially in the last 30 or so years. So I want to ask both our panelists, and I'll start with Commissioner Christie, to name, to identify the principal regulatory and policy changes that have been made over the last 30 years that have affected rates so significantly. And then I'll ask Commissioner McNamee to respond. And off we go. Commissioner Christie.
All right, Ken, well, I need probably a couple of hours to talk about all the bad policies that have led to the inflation in the people's monthly power bills over the last 30 years, because there's been plenty of them. But let me just sort of try to narrow it down. And by the way, people in America are paying way too much for electricity. Think about it. We've been blessed in America. We're sitting on an ocean of gas. We're sitting on centuries worth of coal. We have plenty of oil. We're an exporting nation. The raw materials of electricity production are right here in North America. We don't even have to import those. So we are tremendously blessed. We ought to have be benefiting from that with a lot cheaper power. So what's driven the fact that we're paying so much more for power than as you mentioned, over the last 30 years? I think the policies at both federal and state level have been a huge contributing factor to this. At the federal level, FERC for 30 years has been pushing something which came under the heading of deregulation. And it was a theory. I'm going to steal Bernie's language there. It was a theory that if you broke up the integrated utility system consisting of distribution, generation, and transmission, if you broke it up and if you made the generation side, the supply side, go into these RTO regional markets, it would result in lower prices. And we've got 30 years of data, and it does not result in lower prices. You've got lower prices in the vertically integrated, state-regulated construct states than you do in the states that chose to go down the deregulation path. Well, FERC pushed that. If you go back and read Order 888, if you read Order 2000 at the dawn of this deregulation, FERC was pushing it. FERC was absolutely pushing this move away from a tried and true decades-long model of integrated resource planning, state regulation that had worked. So that's one big, I think, policy error in the last 30 years has been the whole deregulation push. Then, of course, at the federal level under two presidencies, Obama and Biden, you had an outright war on fossil fuel production, an outright war on coal generation, oil generation, gas generation. I mean, literally, that was what the policy goal of those two administrations was, to literally shut those industries down, to shut down electricity generation from gas, coal, oil. And of course, predominantly, we're talking coal and gas, which we have in abundance in America. And yet their policy goal was to shut them down and to try to force a shift into other resources like the intermittent resources. So that, I think that was a huge policy error. And then at the state level, and let's remember one thing, states are the ones who decide what generation sources get used. States are the ones who permit generation. But as we know, a lot of states passed so-called mandatory renewable laws saying we're going to get rid of our gas generation, we're going to get rid of our coal generation, and we're going to force a change to only wind, solar, and that type of resource. And look, wind and solar have a niche. They have a place in the mix. They have no fuel cost, which is an advantage, but they're intermittent. They're not dispatchable resources, which we have to have. So I, you know, if you ask me, and I'm going to say, I'm going to also say this current administration's push on tariffs is adding to the price increases. When you put tariffs, which is a tax on such basic materials as steel, copper, aluminum, which are basic to the utility industry, that drives up the price. You know, conservatives for a long time knew that tariffs were a tax and shouldn't be imposed. President Reagan knew that. But these tariffs are driving up the price. So that so many policy mistakes in the last 30 years, I'm sure if we had more time, I could go into more. But the whole push for so-called deregulation, which again was a brand, it was never a reality. It was really a restructuring of the existing regulatory construct. FERC pushed that 30 years ago and continues to push it. That's been a mistake. The war on coal and gas has been a huge mistake. The mandatory renewable laws at the state level have prevented the creation of new and cheaper resources. So, been a lot of policy errors in the last 30 years. And again, Americans are paying too much for power. We should not be paying what we're paying for power. And then, of course, we can talk in a minute about the load increases that are coming from data centers. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my good buddy, Bernie Activist.
Thank you, Commissioner Christie. Deregulation and decarbonization. Commissioner McNamee?
All right. Well, you know, Commissioner Christie, I think, identified the major drivers of what the problem has been and why electricity prices are going up, but also why reliability is going down. You know, the fundamental thing that the American people demand, but also deserve, is to have reliable and affordable electricity, but that also requires accountability. But reliability, even before the data center rise, was starting to become under threat. We saw particularly in, as Chairman Christie was talking about, in the so-called RTOs regions where competition was supposed to provide reliability and affordability, that there were severe cracks in that and severe threats in that. So let's step back a little bit so I can add a little bit more detail to what Commissioner Christie was talking about. The idea was, when the RTOs were started, was that electricity was just a commodity. It was totally fungible, that you could, every electron was dispatchable, meaning that it could be turned on and off whenever needed, and it could follow what's called the load curve. If you think about it during the day, you know, at midnight, there's not much power being used, but as people wake up at 6 a.m., more and more power is being used as the heat gets higher because of the sun, more AC is used. And so you have to have different resources to meet the need each hour of the day. And that theory of the RTOs was, why don't we use supply and demand to set price and get the most efficient generation resources to meet demand? Good idea in theory, but the nature of electricity is not like other things. First of all, you have to have it every minute of the day. It's not like toothpaste, where if you run out of toothpaste at night, you can run to CVS and buy a new tube. And if they don't have what you like, you go to Walmart to buy another. And if you can't find any toothpaste, you just wait till the next day. You have to have electricity all the time. And so by having a area where, instead of having a utility plan, what used to be called integrated resource planning, that they plan for what are all the resources you need throughout the day and throughout the year to meet either the hottest days of the year or the coldest days of the year. So that was taken through direct planning under the jurisdiction of state regulators. That was taken away. And instead, in these RTOs, you would no longer have, in many areas where the utility could build and plan generation, you would have what are called independent power producers who would decide whether or not it was economic for them to participate. Doesn't mean they're bad. It just means that the economic incentives are different. And then when you started having these state renewable portfolio standards, a clean energy plan saying you had to have more and more of a particular type of resource, particularly intermittent resources, and then you had federal tax credits, of course, capital would go to build what was most advantageous for those investors, not what was needed necessarily for the grid to serve customers. And let's never forget, the grid exists to serve the American people, not to serve the utility and not to serve the investor, the independent power producers. The American people are the ones who pay for this, and they deserve the reliability. But as all these public policies start changing things, what also is happening is marginal pricing that takes place in these RTOs, meaning that no matter what the cost of the resource bid in to meet the need, that the last resource picked and the price they bid sets the price for everybody. So if natural gas traditionally, which set the clearing price, which had, you know, fuel costs, that meant that any resource underneath it got paid the clearing price of natural gas. That meant solar, which has no fuel costs and was getting a tax credit, would get, you know, let's say the normal PJM price of around $40. They would get all of that plus the tax credit. And so what was happening is you were seeing certain reliable, more reliable resources go out, it's a combination of environmental laws and pricing like coal, but you also saw nuclear plants being shut down in these RTOs. And now, of course, we wish we had more of them, and it was almost impossible to build a new nuclear plant in these RTOs, unlike where we saw in Georgia where Vogtle 3 and 4 were built. But my whole point of all this is that, you know, you'll hear people running around markets, 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 or competition, but these are regulatory constructs, as I believe Mark Christie originally called them when he was chairman, but they're also barnacled with many, many regulations by FERC through the states. And to be honest, very few people actually understand how they operate. And what we have seen is a constant churning of saying the markets aren't working, so let's pass a new regulation, usually called a tariff. And we keep on churning and churning. And the problem is that they're not functioning very well. They're not functioning very efficiently. And reliability is going down and affordability is being threatened. And we're not being able to address, particularly with rapid load growth, the type of generation we need to serve customers. And I'm sure you'll get into the transmission issue, but that's another problem that has taken place, is not only on generation, but by disaggregating the planning of generation with transmission, we have now changed the transmission system from really focusing on what the customers need to what do generators want. And I believe that's one of the driving problems of why we're having increased costs also in transmission, which ultimately are paid for by customers.
Thank you, Bernie. Now, let me ask you both. We talk about reliability and accountability and economic incentives. I think it's correct to say that under the traditional utility regulation model that was centered in the states and based on cost of service rate regulation, centered in the state utility commissions, the regulated entity was a single vertically integrated corporation responsible for generation, transmission, distribution, and customer service, and sometimes also the operation of fuel sources like coal mines. And so there was an accountability out of that concentration. And one part of the accountability was under the old construct, the utilities had a legal obligation to serve, to plan, to build, to operate, and to be there when the switches were thrown. But in markets, Commissioner McNamee, you just referred to incentives of generators, and they will decide whether they have adequate incentives to build and produce. Is there anything like, in these deregulated markets, an identifiable, locatable obligation to serve that existed in the old model?
There isn't. You know, the theory of the RTOs, they set what they think that the load needs are going to be need to be and the capacity needs. And there's really, in like say in PJM, there's not all RTOs have this, but there's two different primary markets. One is a capacity market and one is an energy market. The energy market takes place every day, every 15 minutes, including a day ahead, and every 5 minutes day of. And then because the energy markets try to identify the most efficient resource, it's not necessarily providing enough money to get the right type of generation built. So the RTOs will then have what are called capacity markets. And you've heard recently that capacity prices have gone up, you know, hundreds of percent in PJM in particular. But what that's telling you is that the right incentives aren't there. We keep on trying to find new economic products to try and hope that we get new generation built and the right type of generation built. And to your point, in an integrated, vertically integrated system, the utility is required to plan how to have the generation to serve customers, you know, 365 days a year, 24/7. And, you know, that's all under what's called the regulatory compact. You know, there's, you know, the slur of, you know, oh, they're a monopoly. Well, they are a monopoly, but they're a regulated monopoly with their rates regulated and their decisions regulated by state public utility commissions. But they also do, as you said, have an obligation to serve as part of that regulatory compact. So unlike those who participate in the RTOs that have no obligation to serve and merely serve their investors and their shareholders, at least with, you know, when you have a regulated utility, there's an obligation, yes, to serve their own shareholders, but there's also the obligation to serve the customers through their obligation to serve. And with that oversight by state public utility commissions, you also have the accountability that I think is so important in our republic. You know, unfortunately, it's so disaggregated and so opaque at the federal level, you really don't know who to call if the lights go out because there's not enough generation. Do you call PJM or do you call CAISO? Do you call FERC? You know, everybody will point to everybody else. In a vertically integrated state, the public utility commissioners, the state legislatures, the governor, they know to call the president of the utility and say, what's going on? And that's a great deterrent as well to make sure that they're planning properly and having control over prices, which is very important. So, you know, what the American people want are reliable, affordable, and accountable service. And I think that we have seen over this 30-year experiment that the vertically integrated model seems to be producing that.
All right. Thank you. Commissioner Christie?
Yeah, I would agree with Bernie on this. I would add to that. First of all, I'm not even going to dignify these by calling them markets. The PJM capacity market is not a market in any sense that Milton Friedman would recognize. It is a administrative construct with some market characteristics. And I could spend a long time trying to explain this to you. It is a Rube Goldberg contraption. Basically, what PJM does is PJM takes, let's call them orders from the load-serving utilities throughout PJM, saying how much load they are expecting. And then PJM goes and says to the, conducts an auction to fill the orders, let's put it that way, from all the load-serving utilities. And then power producers will bid into the capacity market until they reach where PJM says is the total amount of supply that needs to be achieved. So the only real buyer is PJM. If you're a residential customer and you're the one who wants to keep your lights on, you're not in the PJM capacity market, but you're going to pay for it. And then they're going to use what's called a single clearing price mechanism. So in a regular market, you know, many, many buyers come to the marketplace. Many, many sellers come to the marketplace. If you're looking for lawnmowers, you have any number of stores you can go to find a lawnmower. If Lowe's is offering a lawnmower for $500 and Target's offering a lawnmower for $400 and Tractor Supply's offering a lawnmower for $300, you might say, I'm going to buy the $300 lawnmower from Tractor Supply. It doesn't work that way in the PJM capacity market. What happens is they take bids from suppliers, from generators, and they could have 900 bids at zero, and then the 901st bid is $500 a megawatt day, which is about where we were in Dominion Zone at the last auction. And if that $500 a megawatt day is the last supplier that it takes to reach the demand to meet all the orders that PJM has, well, guess what? Everybody who bid in at zero gets the $500 a megawatt day. It's not really a true market in any sense of the word. There are some market characteristics, but it is an administrative construct. And Commissioner McNamee made a tremendously important point. In the vertically integrated, state-regulated construct, which everybody had until about 30 years ago, and now there's a number of states that still kept that. The southern states kept it, the western states, the Rocky Mountain West, kept it, even though FERC wanted to put everybody into the whole RTO construct. But in those, in the states where you had the vertical, where you had the vertically integrated state regulated construct, you had accountability. Bernie's absolutely right. When you have your state regulator, your utility commission, regulating the whole package, a bundled package of generation, transmission, distribution. If you thought your power bills were too high, you knew who to call. You called your state utility commission, or you called their bosses, the legislature. If you thought if your service is not good, you're having frequent outages, you know who to call. You call your state utility regulator. Again, you call your state legislators if it's bad enough. So you knew, so that the average citizen, the average, you know, retail customer knew who to call. Another way to put it is knew who to blame. And frequently, utility rates, utility service became in many state elections an issue in the election, which is entirely proper. In any democratic system, you should be able to hold your officials accountable that are over something like as important as your electric service. Well, with quote unquote deregulation, and that's a misnomer as well, because it was just a change from one regulatory construct to another regulatory construct. With the so-called deregulation of 30 years ago, here's what happened. Transmission, the responsibility for transmission went from your state officials to FERC, and then FERC to an RTO. Okay, nobody in Virginia has heard of PJM. At least they will if we start having rolling outages. They're going to start hearing about PJM. But so PJM, which covers 13 states, is now operating these markets and these capacity and the capacity market in particular. The responsibility for generating electricity, if your state fully deregulated, went away from your utility that's accountable to your state commission and ultimately to the people of the state, and it went to independent power producers and other players in the PJM capacity market, which do not have the obligation to serve. They have an economic incentive occasionally to bid into the PJM capacity market, but they don't have an obligation to serve because they're not a utility. So Bernie's absolutely right. The accountability was broken when the responsibility for transmission planning and transmission rates in your monthly bill, when that goes away from your state and it goes up to FERC, when the responsibility for acquiring enough generating resources left your state and went to the RTO, the question, if you're just a citizen, you're just a consumer trying to pay your monthly power bill, who are you supposed to call when your lights go out, when your power bill is going up? And yes, there's many contributing factors to that power bill, no question about it. I listed them at the beginning of this program. There's been bad federal policies and there's been bad state policies, plenty of bad policies to go around. But under the state regulated system, you knew who to blame. You knew who to blame your state regulator, your state utility regulator, and over their head, your state elected officials. So you knew who to blame. And, you know, this is sort of a crude way to put it, but a function in a functioning democracy, the citizen needs to know who to blame, right? Because you need to know who you want to vote for next time, because that's the only way you have to try to change the policies that affect your life. And with so-called deregulation, that accountability was broken. It was lost.
Thank you, Commissioner Christie. Let me ask you both a follow-up question about the capacity markets. Utility assets, generation and transmission are just the typical long-lived asset. And for a successful, efficient, cost-effective operation, you should always match finance to operations and cost and so forth. Under the old traditional model, utilities planning to build power stations, if they got it approved by the state regulator, could be reasonably assured that their reasonable costs would be recovered over the life of the asset. But in the capacity market, even on the terms of market enthusiasts, isn't it true that generators can only look to very short periods of time? You know, we're going to win this auction, so we're going to get capacity payments for what? A few months? 1 year? Doesn't that make it more difficult to plan for any generator, independent generator, to plan and get financing to construct the needed resources?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That is one of the primary problems in the capacity market. You know, in PJM, you know, they do it for 1 year, 3 years out. Some places it's six, some other RTOs it's 6 months out, but it's very hard to plan and get financing, and you know, that far out. And that's why, in some ways, why tax credits were, you know, like renewable tax credits, you know, ITC, PTCs were also distorting market prices, because you at least knew you'd have that revenue going forward and that you wouldn't have these fuel costs and you could bid in at zero, but at least into the energy market. So, you know, the argument has been made that the benefit of the RTOs is the risk for building new power plants is put on these independent power producers and their investors. And if something doesn't go right, they pay the price, not customers. And with the flip side saying, if a utility builds a plan in rate base and knows that they're going to get paid back for that and get a return on that, that puts all the risk on customers. Well, the thing is what sort of risks are we trying to balance there? In the capacity markets, the problem is the incentives aren't there to build the resources you need when you need them. And so the risk is the power goes out because you don't have the resources you need, or you have wild swings in these capacity markets like we've seen in the last couple of years with you know, particularly in PJM, but also in MISO with the capacity prices, and in New England for that matter, capacity prices going way up. And now governors and customers and everybody else are upset about that because it hits their bill. Whereas if you have a vertically integrated saying we need this sort of resource, this sort of resource, and this sort of resource, they go to their state commission, they have to prove their case about whether or not it's needed, whether or not it's cost effective for customers, and they get to plan the types of resources they need to serve customers. I will also add that can include renewables. But the one thing, like with solar, which has no fuel costs and has had the tax credits, all those benefits of no fuel costs and tax credits, the utilities had to return to customers. Unlike what happens in the RTOs, where the clearing price is, you know, like Commissioner Christie was saying, if it's $500, that wind or solar developer, they get all that money. The customers don't get the benefit of it, which is another thing we could go on about these so-called low-cost renewables. Might be low-cost to generate, but the benefits don't usually flow to customers. So all that together, you know, to your point is the RTOs just don't seem to be capable of properly, and it's not their fault. They're just doing what they're told to do by FERC and by the system and what the way the paradigm is designed. But the paradigm doesn't work, and it's not working. We've been seeing the wheels come off for a while, and they're really starting to come off now as we've seen load growth grow and our need for so much generation and transmission to meet the AI challenge and other challenges.
Thank you. Now, let me ask you both. If the drivers of the problems, the failures, are decarbonization and deregulation, does that suggest at least the outlines of reform policies, restoration policies, things that could and should be done to restore the reliability, accountability, and cost effectiveness of the traditional system? I mean, a lot of people and a lot of interests are invested in the 30 years long status quo. But Can we get that toothpaste back in the tube? Where do we start? Where do we start? Maybe the administration has already made a start countering decarbonization. But what are your thoughts, both of you, please, on the first, most effective, best two or three steps or policy changes that the federal or state government or those who set the boundary between the two should make to get us back on the road?
Well, I don't think you should say the promise decarbonization. I think the policies that have been adopted as a little bit sweeping. I think it's a good policy to build nuclear. Nuclear is carbon free and it's also dispatchable. And that's a great example of how we can have both reduced carbon emissions and dispatchable power. I think the net zero agenda of the Biden and Obama administrations were just utterly unrealistic. And I think that's how I would phrase it, is utterly unreal. The utter unrealism of like the net zero policies of saying we're going to get rid of coal and oil and gas and to achieve this net zero fantasy, which we're not going to have anytime soon. So I think that the utility policy ought to be about one thing: providing consumers with reliable power at the least cost. If you have that as the guidepost, reliable power at the least cost, then what that argues for is a policy that gets you the reliable power at the least cost. And by least cost, I mean the traditional utility standard of reasonable and prudent expenditures. You know, most of your utility bill is utility assets that the utility has to build to provide you with service. And then, of course, there's fuel cost. And wind and solar have an advantage on fuel. They clearly do. They have no fuel cost, so their marginal cost is going to be zero. But the marginal cost, and of course, you know, in these RTO markets, dispatch based on marginal cost, but the marginal cost is not the full cost of the power. You know, cost of service regulation is based on average cost with a good reason, because there are other costs besides fuel that have to be taken into account. And the discussion we've been having on the failure of these RTO markets is largely because they dispatch on marginal cost. And if the marginal cost of fuel is zero, well, then you're going to favor the intermittent resources that have no fuel cost. But at the same time that's happening, you're not valuing the reliability value of dispatchable resources like coal and gas, which have a tremendously high reliability value. And it's not being valued in these markets that dispatch purely on marginal costs. So Bernie's right. The economic, this is not a moral judgment. These markets are following the economic incentives that have been built into them. But the problem is the electric system should be about providing a public service to all consumers on a non-discriminatory basis and getting reliable power at the least cost. And the ways you do that is we just have to have I call it reality-based. We have to have a reality-based approach. And you don't have to argue that decarbonization itself is bad. What you have to argue is, simply the reality is, we can't keep the lights on for years to come and probably decades to come without dispatchable resources. And that's going to be a large proportion of that's going to be fossil fuel based. It's going to be coal and gas. So I call it a reality based policy. We have to have coal and gas fired generation and try to keep building nukes. Nukes is extraordinarily expensive, but you know what? It's worth it when you get those nukes built. And Bernie made a good point too. You're only going to get nukes built in a vertically integrated structure where the utility can rate base the generation. You are not, we have gotten zero nukes built in PJM. In fact, we've lost nukes in PJM because the market structure is not even remotely sufficient to keep them running. So we've lost nukes in PJM. We haven't gotten a single one built, and you're not going to get them built without the traditional utility financing option available. So I look at it as the policies ought to be reality-based. They ought to be fact-based. And if you do that, the outcomes are going to be, we're going to keep running coal and gas for a long time to come and hopefully build nukes. because you can't keep the lights on unless you you're building these dispatchable resources, and that's just reality.
Yeah, Commissioner McNamee,
I think Commissioner Christie is absolutely right about the description about, you know, the basic policy issue is you know, both the addressing, you know, some of these decarbonization policies at the federal level, at the state level, and then the economic issues. I think that in addition, like, there's one other thing that's going on that we haven't focused a lot on, and that is, and that goes to your point about, can we put the toothpaste back? In short, probably not directly, but there are some things we can do. But I do think that there's something that the audience probably needs to think about as well, is in PJM, where you have, you know, 13 states and DC, you know, there's multi-states, different state policies. And but the problem is one state's policy, if they have like a, you know, a very strong renewable goal, that's impacting other states that don't. And so a lot of states are saying, well, we're going to reach 100% renewables. And then they point to the other state to say that also has that, but we're going to import power from our neighbor. And then there's others that actually are producing power, and then their power is being moved from their customers and sent to other states. And the problem is you don't have necessarily an alignment of state policies. Whereas, you know, in California ISO, at least you have a single state ISO and state public policy that are united. Same in New York, they still have some problems, but they're, you know, there's at least the impacts of the public policy decisions are more located to the same state. I think when we're looking at what are solutions, if we can't put the toothpaste back in the bottle, this actually happened under the leadership when Commissioner Christie was chairman at FERC, and he had a technical conference about some reliability issues. And there seemed to be a growing consensus of the various panelists where he was chairing as host that perhaps we need every what's called load serving entity, really every utility, co-op, anybody who's serving, that they have to contract for all of their capacity needs, that they have to be responsible for signing long-term contracts to make sure that they have the power that they need. So they just can't hope that the market provides it to them in these marginal pricing. It's not necessarily a perfect solution, but it's an interesting idea that at least starts getting a little bit more alignment of public policy decisions and the obligation to serve with the local provider. Doesn't solve all the problems, but it at least starts to get an ability to maybe get the financing needed and to get some reality checks among the local politicians, the local policymakers about what's necessary to, and what's the cost going to be to make sure you have a reliable power and also meet, if you have high clean energy goals, how much it's going to cost to meet them.
Okay,
thank you. Let me add to that, Ken. I know the idea that you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. And I was sort of sneaking a look at some of the questions in the Q&A, and people are asking that same question. Actually, what you can do, and Virginia is a good example. Virginia started down the road to deregulation in 1998. In 1998, Virginia had passed a bill to deregulate, full scale, full Monty deregulation. And then in 2007, the General Assembly, and when I was on the State Corporation Commission, we warned them it wasn't going to work. And they listened to us, actually, probably the only time in the last 25 years. But they listened to us, and they passed a bill to stop deregulation in the 2007 session. But Virginia has a hybrid model. Okay, Virginia decided in 2007, and it remains in effect, we're going to allow our load-serving utilities to own generation. We're going to let them own it and rate base it. But we're not going to have an exclusive monopoly where no other generators can sell or generate within the borders of the Commonwealth of Virginia. So in Virginia, we have both utility-owned generation and we have independent power producers, IPPs. And so that's a hybrid model where you have generation that can be owned by utilities. And that's why Dominion is running four nukes to this day, because they get to rate-based financing, and otherwise those nukes wouldn't be open if they'd been forced to submit those to the PJM markets. They'd be shut down by now. But we have nukes running in Virginia, which are owned by the utility. We have several combined cycle gas generators that are owned by the Dominion. I voted to approve every one of them when I was on the State Corporation Commission, and those got built. They were rate based. At the same time, we have a substantial number of IPPs in Virginia. All it takes to build an IPP in Virginia is you go to the State Corporation Commission and you get a certificate of public convenience, a CPCN. You know, and the SEC has been very willing to approve CPCNs. I know we approved several when I was on the commission. So we have several IPPs generating in Virginia. That's a hybrid model. What it would take in states that the states that went all the way on deregulation, which meant they forced their utilities to get out of the generation business and buy it in the PJM markets, those states could say, we're going to let IPPs continue to operate, but we're now going to let our utilities own generation as well. And they could do that. I don't think I would call that putting the toothpaste back in the tube. I would just say that's just adapting to the reality of where we are, which is we need a lot more generation in PJM. And those states that have been banning their utilities from building generation can say, we're going to let our utilities build generation. We're going to let IPPs continue to build. We're going to let IPPs continue to operate. But we're going to do like Virginia, and we're going to let our utilities build generation as well. So I don't see that as any big, I mean, that's a policy change, but you know, the idea that, well, the toothpaste is out of the tube, you can never put it back. I don't really buy that imagery, because states can allow their utilities to own generation again without shutting down the IPPs. They can certainly be favorable to having IPPs operate as well.
Thank you, Commissioner. Now, I have a couple more questions for both of you, but let me pause and ask staff, Federal Society staff, if they have questions from the audience, because we want to be sure, if there are some, we want to be sure to get them in.
Perfect. I will start reading questions from the audience. And just a quick reminder, if you have any questions, please feel free to leave them in the chat. So first question, which states have retained the vertically integrated model? How many states, and what can we learn from these states?
Well, I'll jump in on PJM, and if Bernie wants to add to this. So in PJM, and this is one of the problems of PJM, it is so diverse, and the states have such different policies. So you have states like New Jersey, Maryland, Delaware, Pennsylvania, I think, that went down the deregulation path. I think in Illinois, it's actually split. Half of Illinois is deregulated. Half of Illinois is still vertically integrated. So those states went down the deregulation path, and I think they're the ones who are suffering the most right now from the PJM capacity market skyrocketing prices. You have traditional vertically integrated states like West Virginia, Indiana, Kentucky in PJM. And then you've got a hybrid state like Virginia, where Virginia has both utility-owned generation in a vertically integrated construct where the retail rates are set by the state regulator. And then Virginia allows IPPs as well. So that's how I would describe PJM. And maybe Bernie wants to describe more around the rest of the country.
Sure. As a general proposition, the Southeast does not have an RTO. Let's back up. There are seven RTOs in the country, six of them which are FERC jurisdictional. There's ERCOT in Texas, which is not. But many regions of the country do not have RTOs. And some of the primary areas are basically most of North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, parts of Tennessee, and of course some others, and then out more towards the Mountain West, though they're starting to move slightly towards ideas of an RTO, or at least some aspects of markets. But if you've looked at the data over the years, what's interesting is, particularly in the Southeast, the states without RTOs have had electric rates that have been below the national average, have had better reliability, and to be honest, have been meeting their state public policy goals. So I think the evidence has shown that those models have actually worked better for customers in terms of the reliability, affordability, and accountability aspects. And also think about it, as Judge Christie was saying, The only two new nuclear plants that have been built in this country were in Georgia, which was vertically integrated. And the few places where you see nuclear power starting to possibly come back into existence is where data centers, you know, are saying that they'll put up the money and sign a long-term contract to pay for it. Well, you know, that's great for them. And it's good in certain aspects for the country if it's new power, period. But, you know, all customers should have the opportunity to participate in that. And, you know, the vertically integrated model helps that happen.
Can you have, so for our second question, can you have a vertically integrated state regulated utilities and still give the customer options to buy from?
Yes. And Virginia does. Virginia allows, it allows big customers. I think it's 35 megawatt load. If you're 35 megawatt load or above in Virginia, the buyer can actually go and do what's called shopping. I mean, if they can find an IPP that offers a deal that they'd rather have, they can strike a what's called a PPA, purchase power agreement, with that separate generation supplier. Now, they still have to pay the utility for the wires because there are not multiple sets of wires out there. And so they have to pay for their transmission service and they have to pay for their distribution. The answer to your question is, yes, there are constructs where you have a vertically integrated utility and certain customers, usually it's the very large ones, are allowed to go out and sign a contract with a separate supplier. But again, you still have to pay for the wires. You still got to pay for the grid, as you should, because if you want to connect to the grid, you ought to pay your share.
And just to add in that, one of the challenges on that sort of sometimes called retail choice is that if particularly large customers are going, you know, they think they're getting a better deal, you know, by buying away from the utility, then they decide the deal is not so good. They want to come back to the utility. It's very hard for the utility to plan, and it can shift costs onto other retail customers. So you got to look at what's the impact of those decisions on all customers, because if you have customers that are going in and out, or if you have, you know, fewer customers in general, then other costs are going to go up for the remaining customers. So it's not kind of just a simple, oh, let's just have, you know, retail choice, so to speak, in the vertically integrated, because part of the theory of the regulatory compact is if you have all customers and you have an obligation to serve all customers, you're able to reduce costs for all customers because basically the denominator in the ratio is smaller.
Yeah, that's a very good point. If you have that type of provision like Virginia does, you've got to look at the impact on other customers. And that's why they have things like minimum stay provisions. If you want to go buy your power from somebody other than the utility, and you're a big load, let's say you're a data center, and let's say you're pulling down 500 megawatts or 1,000 megawatts. I mean, it's not unusual now for data centers, and we in Virginia know all about it, to be pulling the load equivalent to a small city. So if you want to go and sign a PPA with another generator, okay, Virginia law lets you do that, but you're going to pull a lot of load that the utility had planned for, and you have to pay your cost of what they've already done if they had to set up network upgrades and pay for new transmission. And we haven't spent only much time on this, Ken, in this whole program, but one of the upward cost pressures of power is the massive load we're seeing from data centers. And those all require network upgrades. They typically require transmission upgrades and new generation. And you have to look at the cost on other customers. And Bernie made a very good point about if you're a data center and you want to go, let's say you want to leave the utility and you want to go shop from another a generator, okay, but if you caused substantial amount of increased wires expenses, then you should be responsible for that. Just if you're going to leave. And you can't come and go every 6 months because the utility has to make substantial investments based upon serving you with that tremendous amount of power that you require.
Going off the data center question, can a data center build their own generating capacity and be totally off-grid? Or could they buy an existing coal plant's full output and take this off-grid and run it at 100%?
Oh, and Bernie, go on there.
It kind of depends. If you're in a vertically integrated state, usually if the data center builds and operates its own power plant and it's not connected to the rest of the grid, they can probably do it. If somebody else builds them the power plant and wants to serve them in a vertically integrated state, probably not, because that would violate the franchise. The big issue is, even nationwide, is most data centers want to be connected to the grid. You know, you might have an outage at your power plant. You might have to, you know, fix something there, and you still going to need to get power from the grid. And once you're connected to the grid, whether you're vertically integrated in an RTO, you're going to have to pay for, as Judge or Commissioner Christie was saying, you're going to have to pay for the transmission upgrades. You're going to have to pay for a lot of other services, and then also try and deal with the power plants. But, you know, some data centers are signing deals to pay for generation. You know, we've seen, like, I believe it's Meta is getting Three Mile Island turned back on, and they're going to do it directly and get that power. But I believe that they're still going to be connected to the grid in some manner.
What legislation does it require to allow utilities to build a generation? Is it state or federal?
State. The states have absolute authority over deciding whether their utilities, the states have the authority to decide what the regulatory construct should be. And that includes the states decide whether they're going to let their load-serving utilities own generation or not own generation. FERC pushed the deregulation, and I have to use that term even though it's a branding term, not reality. Somebody asked in the Q&A, is this like telephone deregulation or airline deregulation? No, it's not at all. It is, again, just a change in the regulatory construct. States were basically pushed by FERC, and the utilities were pushed by FERC in the early part of this century, in late 1900s. FERC pushed it, but states had to actually pass the legislation to allow their utilities to join RTOs. So it's state law entirely that could be changed if they want to allow those states who prohibited their utilities from owning generation. That's state law, and states can change the law.
And I think we have time for one last quick question. What is the recommended solution recognizing the federalism construct of the utility system?
Well, that's the theme we've had throughout this, is that, you know, the theory of federalism is that twofold. One, that the states have the authority to make their own decisions, particularly as police power, and that the federal government, you know, can regulate interstate commerce, but that they don't have to regulate everything. And when the Federal Power Act was adopted in the 1930s in response to what was called the Attleboro Gap, a Supreme Court decision about regulating electric rates across state lines, that's fine. But we went for another 70 years in which states still had primary responsibility through their utilities to plan the distribution, transmission, and generation of electricity and set rates. And there were things called power pools where electricity was passed across state lines and it worked fine. So, you know, my view would be is go back to the original federalism concept and have as much accountability as you can, and that will happen at the state and local level instead of having it in these opaque RTOs or through FERC.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with Bernie. The states have within their police powers the authority to regulate public utilities. That has always been within states' inherent police powers. And the Federal Power Act, which was originally passed in the 1930s, simply carved out for a new federal agency called the Federal Power Commission. Actually, had been around since the 20s to do hydro, but it was but the power over what the modern day FERC regulation is really based on the changes that were made in the 1930s. So the Federal Power Act carved out some authority for this federal agency, which is now called FERC, and it's to regulate rates over wholesale power that's sold in interstate commerce or transmission sales in interstate commerce. And that's basically what FERC has authority to do. And the whole RTO construct is, in my opinion, is way beyond what Federal Power Act ever gave FERC the authority to do. And it represents a big expansion of federal power. And I also have to add at this point, surprisingly, you've got the Trump administration pushing FERC to do a massive expansion of federal power at the expense of the states by taking over the terms and conditions of how large load retail customers interconnect. Retail interconnection has always been under state authority. It should be under state authority. And the current Department of Energy is pushing FERC to preempt the states and take it over, which to me is a completely contrary to the whole idea of rolling back the deep state Project 2025. It's completely contrary to that. I'm a big believer in federalism. I am a big believer like Bernie that states are the place where decisions ought to be made that fit the way Americans live their lives. This is consistent with James Madison, Federalist number 45. And so I think FERC's job is to stick to what the statute says, which is regulate rates for wholesale power sales in interstate commerce and regulate transmission rates also in interstate commerce. And that's what FERC ought to stick to and leave the states able to regulate the rest of the electric power system. Because again, for accountability, this is what federalism means, is keeping those decisions at the state level and not having FERC intrude and take them over when it should be a state decision.
Thank you very much. That's all the time we have for questions. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. And I want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We also welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. As always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today, and we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.